I'm Anne Strange-Shams, and today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're asking a simple question. After November 8th, where do we go as a country? After weeks of fractious campaigning and divided politics, is it possible to reconcile, to restore political civility? Well, for guidance or inspiration, I thought maybe we could turn to the nation's founders. I mean, they kept it together. They hashed out a constitution and created a country without savaging each other, right? Well, Paul Aaron is a historian who works for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. He's got a different story to tell. The title of his book says it all, Founding Feuds, a story of bitter rivalries and intense conflicts in the early days of the Republic. It turns out the Founding Fathers could be just as vicious and just as scathing as politicians today.
The insults that they had puts us to shame. It is so much more scathing and so much more eloquent. One of my favorites is Thomas Jefferson writing to James Madison about Patrick Henry, and he summed it up by saying, "What we have to do, I think, is devoutly to pray for his death."
Oh.
Or you have Abigail Adams on Alexander Hamilton. "I have read his heart and his wicked eyes many a time. The very devil is in them." Or this one. I mean, George Washington liked to generally stay above the fray, and most people were afraid to attack him. But Thomas Paine wrote to him, said, "And as to you, sir, treacherous in private friendship, for so you have been to me, and a hypocrite in public life, the world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles or whether you ever had any." I could go on.
Well, you know, for those of us demoralized by the bitterness of this year's election, it's kind of reassuring to discover that not only were some of the founders' feuds just as bad, but in many cases they also managed to reconcile. And Adams and Jefferson, for instance, they began as friends, and then they ran against each other twice, which seemed to destroy their friendship, to such an extent that the last time, when Jefferson won, Adams left Washington, D.C. on the morning of the inauguration, and he never came back. But near the end of their lives, they somehow became friends again.
As with so many of the founders' feuds, there is a happy turn. In 1812, Adams sent Jefferson a New Year's greeting, and Jefferson responded warmly. And that unleashed a flood of letters, 158 between 1812 and their deaths on July 4th. 1826. And that's a story that's been told many times, but I can't resist mentioning it.
It's just so,
so amazing that they both died on the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. In their letters, Adams wrote, "You and I ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other." And boy, did they explain themselves to each other and also to us. I mean, they talked about philosophy, they talked about politics, as if their differences had never been personal. Mm. Jefferson wrote back to Adams, "We do not think exactly alike. Matters little to our country, which we have delivered to our successors." And I think Jefferson was certainly right that they didn't think alike, but he was wrong that it doesn't matter to us. Their letters are a testament both to their feud and to their friendship.
Well, that's lovely, but you know, then there was also the most famous feud between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, which ended with Hamilton dead. I was actually trying to think what a contemporary equivalent would be. Someone said it would be as if Joe Biden shot Condi Rice. Is that a fair analogy?
It's a completely fair analogy. I mean, this was a duel between the former Treasury Secretary and the Vice President. So, yes. Rice is the former Secretary of State, not former Treasury Secretary, right. But the analogy is absolutely apt. I mean, given how vehement these duels were, how nasty the words were, in one sense, it's remarkable that there wasn't more bloodshed.
After that, Burr traveled west and was accused then later by Thomas Jefferson of conspiring to set up a whole new nation out of Spanish territories. So it seems like that duel, that argument, just led straight into yet another big national
rift. Another duel. I mean, Burr headed west after shooting Hamilton. And then in 1805, rumors reached Washington of a plot to make Burr emperor of a new nation cut out of Mexico and the American West. And Jefferson concluded he was guilty and made sure that Burr was charged. And again, this is the former vice president was charged with treason.
What a tangled, complicated history. What wound up happening to Burr in the end?
Well, here perhaps is another sign of perspective that the founders can give us. In his last days, Burr was reading the novel Tristram Shandy, and this is a novel in which a character is tormented by a fly, and he catches it, and he lets it go, saying, "This world is surely wide enough to hold both thee and me." And Burr's almost last words, according to his 19th century biographer, were, "I should have known that the world was wide enough for Hamilton and me." So perhaps Burr deserves some appreciation in this age where we are as divided as the founders. He was certainly an opportunist. The criticism of him as such was valid. But he did try to appeal to both Federalists and Republicans, even if it was only to advance his own ambitions. And perhaps, as I said, that provides some lesson for us, given our own ideological divides.
Well, I was thinking that the great thing about this nation and this democracy is that no matter how heated and vicious our political battles get, especially around the time of an election, in the end, we have always managed to transfer power peacefully. And in the end, there's an inauguration and one person stands up at that lectern and has to say something to heal the nation, to heal this divide, bring people back together, you know, reconcile people to the point that they can at least work together. What are the great moments that you think of, the people who've done that really, really well, that moment of bringing the nation back together?
I think
again?
Jefferson certainly did a wonderful job of reconciling the Federalists and the Republicans in his inaugural address. It was very conciliatory. He reached out to both parties. "Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle," Jefferson said in his inaugural address. "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." And perhaps that, too, is a hopeful note for today. It kind of would be nice to hear someone say, "We are all Republicans. We are all Democrats." I think another wonderful example of reconciliation would be Thomas Paine and William Cobbett. Paine is fairly well known as, of course, the author of Common Sense and American Crisis. These were pamphlets that inspired Americans to independence and to revolution. Paine was too radical for most of the founders. His support for the French Revolution, his attacks on religion were just too much for most of the founders. John Adams said of Paine that he was begotten by a wild boar on a bitch wolf. And Adams also said, "Never before in any age of the world has there been such a career of mischief." And you would think, as insults go, that would be tough to top. But William Cobbett, another popular and aggressive writer of the time, but on the Federalist side, managed to attack Paine even more viciously. Cobbett wrote, "How Tom gets a living now or in what brothel he inhabits, I know not. Like Judas, he will be remembered by posterity. Men will learn to express all that is base, malignant, treacherous, unnatural, and blasphemous by the single monosyllable, Paine." And yet, there is a reconciliation. When Cobbett returned to England, he found himself disillusioned by the corruption and inequality he saw there. And he was also not happy about being jailed there for sedition. So he turned around and decided that Paine was right about everything. And this led to one of the most remarkable stories I've heard, which is that in 1819, Cobbett stumbled through the dark in New Rochelle, where Paine was buried. And he dug up Paine's corpse with the intent of taking the bones to England so a proper monument could be built for Paine there. And at the customs inspection in Liverpool, he announced, "There, gentlemen, are the mortal remains of the immortal Thomas Paine." And somehow he did manage to get them through customs. But we don't know what happened to Paine's bones. It's one of the mysteries of history. We know Cobbett's son, J.P., inherited the bones when Cobbett died in 1835, but no one knows where they are today.
Wow. Just as you think you know our history, and just as you think things today couldn't be stranger or worse, that's quite a story.
It could be just as nasty and just as strange.
Paul Aaron is a historian and the director of publications at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. We were talking about his book, Founding Feuds: The Rivalries, Clashes, and Conflicts That Forged a Nation.